Halacha and medicine.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll be sitting this evening. Makes it much easier and perhaps less formal, because the topic is which has to be restrained within certain boundaries is mainly the way I was told originally. It's not just a question of general medical issues, but it's a question of what we would call end of life or determination of end of life issues, which is a very critical area that comes up constantly, at least rabbanim that are in the field, even congregational rabbis that have a variety of people in their congregations. People become ill, families are involved, and they have to make certain particular decisions as what they're going to do, whether they can instruct doctors, listen to doctors, how far they have to have what we call a reliance on the expertise of the various physicians. And also where physicians many times have a different view of humanity during their training and so forth, the human being, how they judge them, how they assess them, and especially when it comes to age, things of that sort. So these matters crop up all the time in families. There's one very important point that has to be remembered before we just talk about a certain source. Remember, this is a very complicated and extensive type of topic, which would involve many in-depth halachic shiurim, which I, of course, will not touch upon today. I just touch upon some of the highlights and the sources and the nature of the controversy that exists. But before we do that, there's one important point that has to be remembered, and that is emphasized, that the human body, the body as we know it, does not belong to each and every one of us. We are not the owners of our bodies. And that's the way it's brought down in halacha in various places. One of the very clear-cut statements is in the Shulchan Aruch of the Rav, of the Baal HaTanya, in the short area of Chesha Mishra, which he has there towards the end of the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, where he emphasized that we are more or less the custodians. We are given a custody of the goof, of the body, which Hashem gives us. As a result of that, it's not what people see and what people read. Well, I can do whatever I want with my body. I can endanger it. I can go here. I can make certain decisions. It's my life. And it's really not. We use the term my life, but life is a great gift that is given by Hashem on different levels to different people and different backgrounds and different places, but fundamentally it belongs to Hashem. So in the decision process, what is the way of deciding? The Torah, the believing Jew, has the halacha, the Jewish law, and the principles of combined Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, where it's come down to us through the ages, and with the consultation of science and technology within the boundaries of halacha, that's how we try to have to make a particular decision. Now, the big controversy today, and has been in medicine, and it goes on and on, is the controversy of end of life. In other words, what determines, and it's not the most pleasant subjects or so forth, but what is the determination of death? How do we determine that? People will say, well, the heart stops beating, and that's that. Well, it's not that simple or so forth, especially in a day and age when you have machines and technology that can artificially stimulate and keep the heart beating for a length of time on what we call a ventilator or so forth. And so where do we have a bit of a discussion? I'll just point to one particular source of the Gemara that deals with it, which most of the Paskim have dealt with it. One of the Gedolim, the great rabbinic minds that was here in America and were mostly recognized as the primary decisor of American Jewry was Moshe Feinstein Zal, who got involved in many decisions and printed many decisions dealing with medical problems, associated with life situations, life-threatening situations, and of course what we call the Kvias Hamavos, the establishment of death. Now, you should know that in 1968 there came out and it became a matter of subject ruled upon later on and accepted by the judicial system in many states, what is known as the Harvard criteria of establishing death. The studies that were done there by medical experts in Harvard and so forth, there are reports about it, people probably could have access to it. They determined that something called brain death is death, even if the heart is beating. But if, just saying it very simple, we'll try to give a bit more details on that, that if there's no brain function, if there's what they call irreversible brain function, that the patient can never put all the assets of medical science cannot reverse the patient to a functioning human being. If the brain is what they call dead, and again we'll have to come to a more specific point, they say that is considered death. That was known as the Harvard criteria. So as a result of that, it became a great tumult in religious circles and other circles. Well, isn't cardiac cessation, the lack of the heart of part beating, of cardiac activity, that always, you know, we always would think the person would feel the heart or listen to the heart beating. If it stops, then that the person's considered has gone from the world. But if it's still beating, no matter what happens in another part of the body, the person could say is alive. So this is I'm saying in very simple terms. Now, where do we find a Gemara? And that's the basis of the Gemara Mishnah and the Gemara that deals with the question of where do we measure, what do we test to establish whether a person has come to the end of life. And it's a situation of an accident. The Mishnah in Yuma, in Pei Gimel, Amud Beis, but the Gemara is in Pei Hei, Masech the Yuma, and within the context of the Mishnah dealing with Dinim of Yom Kippur, about Pikuach Nefesh on Yom Kippur, and so forth. So what happens if Nofla Olav Mapelis? There's a disaster, a house falls down, collapses. Like you have in storms and things, these things are happening. Unfortunately, they happen in the United States and other things when there's what we call a disaster. And we know there's somebody buried underneath the house. In fact, even the Mishnah says we don't even know whether it's a Goy or whether it's a Jew, whether he's alive, whether he's not alive, and so forth. But if there's a suspicion that he's talking about from the obligation to desecrate the Shabbos or Yom Kippur, if there's a possibility that if he's a Jewish person, we are obligated to save his life. On a public basis, we would be obligated to save anybody's life because of the question of Chil Hashem, problems of other problems, but I'm not going into that. So the Gemara talks about that, and it says, Mafakrin Olav Esagal. We start to remove, use all means possible to uncover, which you're doing malacha, move the stones, the rocks, the debris to get to the person. So we come, let's say they reach the body. So there's a discussion over there, when you start making, you want to find out whether the person's alive or dead. If he's already dead, you stop. You don't have to desecrate Shabbos and Yom Kippur anymore. He's gone. Why do that? You can wait till after Shabbos and Yom Kippur is over and then remove the remains. But if there's a possibility that a person is alive, you must do everything possible to save his life, to maintain whatever life, call it life force, a person has. So how do we make the bedika, the inspection, in trying to find out whether a person is alive? Because the person has obviously been crushed or badly injured, is lying there, and the way Rashi even mentions is munach, he's lying like a mess, like a dead body, a sofa. How do you know? How do you test him? So the Gemara gives two approaches, and then it's going to talk about from what direction you're coming. It can either be at beit kenoser at chaitmo, you can go and make the investigation all the way up to his nose. Let's say you uncover his head, you reach the nose, and you find out whether there's breath coming out of the nostrils over there. If there is, it means that he's alive, you have to uncover him. If there's not, according to that opinion, you can stop right then and there. Because, in fact, they quote the pasuk, Kol Asher Ba'apov Nishmas Chaim. Everything, that's a pasuk that you find there in Parshas Noach, with the flood. All creatures in the world that have the soul, the breath of life. So, and it's talking about Ba'apov, in the nose, the nostrils, and so forth. You know, people can do that. You don't even have to be a doctor. You can put a mirror in front of that. You can put something to see where there's breath coming out. Although we don't know what's going on in the heart. We haven't reached the heart. So that's the whole point. The other...
Seriously, what about his stuffed nose when he's breathing out of his mouth?
Well, they're talking about chokmo. Where there is something coming from, breath coming out of the nose.
Oh, so it's all proving affirmatively there's life, not negative.
I mean, you want to interrupt and explain something? I mean, I would appreciate that.
Sorry.
But I'm just describing what the Gemara says and so forth. I'm not challenging it medically or not. But that's where it is. In fact, there are stories in the world literature of someone who went into a catatonic state. Famous story. Someone seemed to drop dead on the street. They took him to a funeral, and the doctor that examined him couldn't hear a heartbeat. Couldn't hear a heartbeat. So they took him to the funeral chapel. They were ready to embalm him. And the supposed mess is lying there on the table, about to embalm, and suddenly he starts moving. So the guy was shocked. It's a famous story. Why? Because sometimes a person falls in a severe catatonic state where an experience, it takes a highly qualified, experienced physician to detect maybe some type of heart. He couldn't detect it. But that person was breathing all the time. He was not dead. So, but getting back to the Gemara, it says, Ad Chaitbay. The other opinion says, Ad Libo. You go all the way to the heart. But what does it mean, go all the way to the heart? So the Gemara qualifies that. It depends on which direction you're coming from. If you're coming mimata lamaila, from below the lower part of his body, and they reach the heart, they couldn't find a heartbeat, you don't stop. According to that opinion, you keep going and try to go to the nose area to see where there's any breath or so forth. So, which seems to indicate that it's not the heartbeat that is the major deciding factor. And then the other way around, if they couldn't get any breath from the top, they stopped right then and there. That's basically the pshat in the Gemara, the way it's discussed over there. And the Rishonim, the earlier Paskim, the Rav Alfus, the Rambam, and others, and it's even in the Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Shabbos, and Siman Shin Chof Tes, and Or Chaim, that says that would be the way that would be done. So what is the concept? The concept is that the heartbeat alone is not a sign of life. Heartbeat alone is not a sign of life. Now, let's qualify that. Meaning that if you have an artificial, if you have a ventilator that will keep moving keep the heart beating, inflating the lungs and so forth, and let's say the brain has suffered irreversible damage to the effect, and this is the step that is discussed further in Puskin and all, there's no blood flow now to the brain. There's the cortex doesn't allow for any blood to come in there and so forth. I'm not going into the whole physiology of the skull and everything else over there, So that would mean that the patient really is dead. The heart is beating artificially. In fact, it has been proven, still proven, even on experiments. The person can take the heart out of an animal, move the living heart of an animal, put it in a bucket of salt water, the heart will keep beating. Will keep beating. Does it mean that the dog is alive? It means that that organ is kept going. It's kept going. There are a lot of things in tissues or parts of the body that can be removed, and there are ways with different machines or processes to keep blood or things flowing in those particular tissues. It doesn't mean that from... So where is the real person? What defines the person as individual that it would be considered dead is there, but as one place where once that the brain is irreversibly damaged and no blood flow comes through that, that would really mean that the person has expired. Now, this approach, now that's what even the religious physicians and so forth, neurologists have, I mean, that's the way they've explained it. They've asked opinions of halacha. So what does halacha say about that? If you could still keep the heart beating regardless what happened to the brain, does it mean that the person is alive or not? That's where you have the big controversy. But the background is from that Gemara there in Yuma. There are other Gemaras that describe situations where a person who has been so cut apart, split in the back or so forth, as you know, in Chulin and Afalov, and other places, suffered such a wound that, according to Allah, he's dead. Although there might be some aspects of reflexes or movement of what the Chazal call pirchus, trembling or reflexes, but the person is already considered a mess, so that a Kayan couldn't go into that room where that person suffered that type of wound. In fact, if a person says that that patient is already brain dead, the Kayan could not go into that room, because that patient's already considered gone, and a Kayan is not supposed to be Matama Lames. That would be the differences. Now, there's other opinion that says absolutely not. No matter how the heart is kept beating, the patient is alive, and so forth. But you see that if you remove that organ and kept it beating, does it mean the patient is alive? Now, Moshe Feinstein, in talking about the concept of brain death, uses the idea that once there is no perfusion of dam, of blood into the brain area, or so forth, and which because the blood that is pumped really from the heart into the brain feeds the brain, it gets there, it's oxygen, it's glucose, and so forth. Once that stops, the brain actually suffers irreversible damage. After a while, if there's an expression that uses it, lice, L-Y-S-I-S, there's a deterioration of that activity or so forth. So Reb Moshe, who consulted with many physicians in the matter, he didn't just make this up, in examining the halacha and several tshuvas in the section of Yeridaya with the Simen Kuf Lamed Beis in the third one, which is the most controversial one, and then also in the second chelik, says it's similar to physical decapitation. If there's no blood flow going to the brain and the brain can't move, it's as if the person's head has been removed from him. Now, is anybody going to say that after decapitation that the person is alive, although the heart might be kept beating? Supposing it was happened that way, they kept the heart beating, can't say that the patient is alive. He's gone. He's missing that most vital part of the body, without which, I mean, he can't do anything. In fact, the language of Rashi over there is, in the case of the person found in the where everything fell down upon him and so forth, is munach kemes, eina mezis eivoro, doesn't move at all. And if a rabbinic decisor, Baal Haor, if he's understanding enough, will not rely on just his own examination of the halachic background, he will talk to neurologists, to expert neurologists who are surgeons that deal with brain function. When I first came to Chicago, I would say within 3 years, I met with three neurologists in a private house. The three neurologists, one of them still lives in this neighborhood, Dr. Jack Fox. Maybe you know him. He's head of neurology at Rush Medical Center. I met with a resident neurology, Aaron Buckman, who went to Israel. And also a Dr. Melvin Wigder, who was an experienced neurologist. He was in one of the hospitals on the south side, the Christ Hospital. We were there. We met all together in a room, and we were shown slides and things about patients and the manual examination first that neurologists test to see about the reflex of someone who has brain damage. You know, the patient is actually just lying still as a mess. That's what he looks like. And if they test him by, for example, squirting things in water into the ear, by pinpricking the nose, he has no feeling, nothing of that, so forth. That's above and beyond any type of scans now that they have more developed of the brain and everything else of that sort. What they do have, which they had for several years, is, and they even developed further things than that, is some sort of introduction of a nuclear isotope into the IV, into the patient's IV, which he's hooked up anyhow. You don't have to move the patient around whatsoever. And that sends some sort of a diisotope. If it reaches, they can take a scan or a picture of it. It will show whether the cortex there of the brain, where it's blocking the blood flow, that shows as if it's actual physical decapitation. Now, all of these tests have to be carefully done by the neurologist before any Balawa, any Rov can give a decision of if he's going to give the decision. There are certain Balei Haor will not give a decision because they say the heart is beating. They got them out of the machine, it can beat indefinitely. Beat and beat and beat. And that's that. So we don't say arbitrarily to remove the machine because maybe there is some life in the person. Only after all of these careful tests are made, then it's possible to say to disengage from that. And Moshe says that. Moshe says that if there is nothing coming into the brain area, that's already a life. I mean, that's an end of the person's life, so to speak. And it has other ramifications, which I'm going into now. But there's other school of thought, and it's been very bitter, it's been acrimonious to an extent, who says that as far as being barring name calling and so forth, that will say it's only the heart that does that. And if a person detaches the machine under that circumstances, after having established there's no blood flow to the brain, like almost physical decapitation, they will use a term, you're a rotzeach, you're a murderer, you're this and that. And what's interesting, I cut out a newspaper article written by a very competent doctor who was a well-known Talmud Chacham. This was printed in the op-ed page of the Jewish press, and it was written by Dr. Aaron Glatt, M.D. May the brain controversy die a dignified death. That's what he says. And what he's pleading is, he says there are different opinions. And just like in every area of halacha, there are those, you know, yes, eishlim u'matirin, those who prohibit, those who allow, all sorts of things of that sort. Why should there be such acrimony against us people calling all names? They can't have any discussion. There's too much rhetoric that is going on. And says like that, you have to understand that the people are doing this not because they're listening only to what they think is reasonable or not. And there's another point that has to be mentioned in general that the Moshe deals with. It's tangential to this, that sometimes there are people that are reaching their end of life because of the incurability of their situation. There are no palliative measures given by physicians to cure the person, and it's a terminal disease. And the question of how do you attach the person to a ventilator, the person might be in great pain. And if you attach him, it's not going to help him get cured. It will prolong, why would it prolong? His life, or will it prolong his dying? That's the shaila. And even Rav Moshe says, we don't have any obligation to prolong someone who is dying. You are absolutely not to curtail in an active way the process. Like if someone, like I once got a shaila years ago where a frum nurse in a hospital called me up. It was in the late in the evening and said that the doctor ordered for this terminal patient an accelerated morphine drip, which is just like saying they're putting that patient to death. You know, accelerated morphine, that lowers, that depresses the whole blood pressure and everything else, that will end up killing the patient, you know, with that accelerated thing. There's nothing wrong with giving a patient painkillers to alleviate. In fact, that's a mitzvah to do that, to relieve, to have what they call pain management. That's why there are different teams of physicians that specialize on types of pain management. But to be actively involved, what they call kirei misoso, of hastening the end of life, that we're not allowed to do. But at the same time, we're not supposed to prolong the process when there is expiration. And one of the classic cases that is found in the Gemara, it's very controversial, it's like a legendary thing, when the great sage and saint Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the editor of the Mishnah, it was called in the Gemara and the Mishnah Rebbe, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, that he was afflicted with severe intestinal pain and everything else besides others, so terribly severe, and he felt almost like already that he was going to die. And the Chachomim, the Talmidim, were being mespalo, keep him alive. So the Tfilas were keeping him alive, and he was in awesome pain. So it says, Amsa the Rebbe, the Zigmarin Ksubis, the maidservant of Rebbe, couldn't stand to see what pain he was. So to stop the Chachamim, to distract them from davening, she broke something. They suddenly stopped davening. At that moment, he passed away because the Tefillah did not prolong his dying process. In fact, on that basis, on that Gemara, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissen, says an amazing statement. And it sounds almost extreme. He said, just like you have to be mispalo for someone to have a refuah shleima, when you the tefillah you feel is going to help and all of that, you're allowed to be mispalo that a person should end his life without pain. And he brings the proof from that case, because she did something not directly into his body. She distracted, she interrupted the process of prolonging his dying. So this is the balance many times that faces the problem in a family. Families have someone in a family, a parent, an aged person, whatever the situation is in very dire straits. Whether they put him on a ventilator, whether he's not, whether he's already under oxygen, and they will They will want to find out. They want to know what should they do. Should they let go of everything? They want to consult their Rav. And what does the physician say as to what it is? Most of the times, physicians, because they can't make the decision for the patient, they can only advise. And only those who are the legal guardians or custodians of the patient can make that. If the patient himself is incapable of doing that, they will consult. They will ask that. Most of the times in these cases, the doctor will say, well, he's lived long enough. I've heard this many times. Person's old. Yeah, that's what they say. They're very practical. You know, I've lived long enough. So just let him go, you know. Don't do this, don't do that. Pull this, pull the plug, whatever. And so forth and so on. So it's not that easy. So the parents, many families are very confused or upset what to do. So they will call up a Rav and ask the questions. When I'm called about that, the first thing I will ask them, let me speak to the doctor. I want to talk to him, see what he says. What is his possible prognosis? What is the condition of the patient and so forth? And then I will talk to the parents and come to some sort of conclusion whether it's necessary to put the person on a ventilator to keep prolonging the dying process. It's a difficult decision, let me tell you, all the time. And I always tell them, when I give them the guidelines, I tell them, you can do that. Once you do it, you can't take it off. Unless later on you'll have absolute proof that it's brain dead. I mean, at least that would be my approach to it, with all the necessary tests and conditions. But once you put them on, you can't take them off. But if you don't put them on, you're not actively doing anything that will be done later to shorten the person's life process. You just let things take their natural expiration course, which was that's the way it was in history or so forth. When people reached a certain stage of illness or disability, whatever it was, and that you don't have to maintain that much suffering and pain on the person. These are difficult decisions to make. Of course, you hear all the time people say, they'll quote the pasuk, "Lo samer lo dam reyacha," how can you allow a person to die, or so forth. But that's all true. If the person's in tractable pain and you're keeping him alive and giving him more pain, what kind of benefit are you doing to that person? You're not allowed to do that. Not allowed to keep a person in pain if you can possibly stop it. We don't say by shooting him or shorten his life or so, but you don't do things that will prolong the agony. What you'll try to do is give some sort of pain management and advise that. So these are the things that run through people's minds. These are the most difficult decisions. I just want to mention, when I heard years ago when I was learning in the yeshiva, in the college course, we had to take a course what was called in hygiene, in general medicine and health care and so forth. At that time, the teacher, the professor, was Dr. Alexander Fried. This is in the 1940s. Dr. Alexander Fried was a Talmud Chacham himself. He was a Talmud of the Lashon Yeshiva. As they say in Yiddish, you can't learn them. You know how to learn. They spoke with a heavy accent that used to be the butt of many jokes. But he was the head. He was one of the top physicians in the Queen's General Hospital at that time. So he made an important point that left its mark on me. I remember it. Try, because I have responsibility, not just in medical things, but in other things. He says, many times, he says, I have to make a decision about a person, life-saving decisions, to operate, not to operate, do this, do that. He says, at night I pace the floor after I've already done the procedure, made the decision. So I remember that all the time. I pace the floor many times after telling people, this is what you should do, what you don't do. It's a very big responsibility. And not everybody will agree with this position that I am presenting. I mean, I have accepted that position of brain death. And not only Reb Moshe has accepted it, although lately has been a controversy to say whether is that a real tshuva of his, is it a spurious tshuva, does somebody make it up from the family? You know, all these things happen after his passing. And people will say all sorts of things. And there's and the Rabbanus Roshit in Israel as a policy years ago accepted that principle. They have that principle, and Father Rabbanus and Rav Shapira Zal, who was the Rav Roshi then, whom I knew, also wrote in the medical journal Asya an article about that, upholding it, and others opposed it. So Rabbi Avadia Yosef himself also holds that. What's most interesting, I just can refer you to two works. One is in English and one is in Hebrew. In English, there is a book or sefer called Care of the Critically Ill, according to the response of Moshe Feinstein. Both the original text of the Chuvos and English translations, which were prepared by his son-in-law, Rabbi Dr. Tendler, who's still there in yeshiva, who is very well, extremely versed in medicine, as the chairman of the Department of Biology. Many years he discussed medical things or brought medical information to Reb Moshe, as well as many other physicians there who are mentioned in his tshuva. Some of them I knew. So that's all discussed in English. He has it translated in English. Anyone purchased that book, they can read all of the medical problems that are discussed by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, how he advises it in different situations that I've described about the question of brain death, beating of the heart, certain even organ transplantation, which brings us a larger subject, which is very dependent on the status of the heart or of the what we would call the donor, when it can be done, how it can be done, if it can be done, and so forth. And then there's more recently a sefer of halacha written by grandson of Rabbi Avadia Yosef, and it seems he's a great lamdan, he's a great bucky in all of these matters, where he has summed up the whole topic. Is it says kviyas zaman hamavus, the establishment of the time of death. That's the whole topic of it. He has assembled everything that up to this time has been written, all the opinions. He gives a critical review of that, and he comes to the conclusion, as his grandfather Rabbi Avadia Yosef was one of the great Puskim of the generation, accepts that approach, that it is like what we call the Harvard, so to speak, italicized criteria of that. So those are areas which have been written about. Even that Rabbi Wiener, Yaakov Wiener, used to visit here from the Jerusalem Institute of Medical Research, used to come here every year. In his book, You Shall Surely Heal, where he discusses this, but at the end he comes to the conclusion, going back and forth, once you've established that there's no blood flow to the brain, there's no activity, he says, then you can, although the heart might be beating. There's a direct quote there, which I took down, where he says that's the way you would have to rule. He even accepts that under that particular circumstance. So what we all hope and pray is that people should be healthy. Take care. You have a responsibility. The body that Hashem has given us is not to abuse it, not to destroy it. You're responsible to take care of it in any shape, manner, or form possible, and follow the Torah guidelines of a healthy spiritual and physical life. And hopefully we'll never have to come to make these type of decisions.
Okay. Can we take a few questions?
Any
questions? Would you comment about the effect of a secular power of attorney where a person has expressed a desire that his life not be prolonged? And I'm talking particularly in terms of removing artificial devices.
Yeah. Well, that's the person has, in other words, if the person, for example, has given a written what we call a living will or advanced medical directives, which in many hospitals and nursing home facilities they require it when a person is registered there or when it's taken in. You have to have it on record so they know what to do. So a person has a right to do that, to direct that person but it should not be, it depends how the language is. He doesn't want, for example, one of the big problems always is about a DNR, what we call do not resuscitate. In case of a cardiac arrest on the patient, now what happens is the hospital or the medical facility, if there's no such order, they have to intervene with massive, aggressive, vigorous, and brutal intervention to get that heart started. They will beat on the chest, they will do all sorts of things with fibrillate and so forth. In the process, if it's an elderly patient who is quite old, they'll kill him immediately. They'll break the ribs and everything else of that sort. And the patient is very frail. So in such a case, a DNR is advisable. I mean, people have asked me, I say, you could do that. Otherwise, you're kirev misosa. You're immediately. And I've discussed it with doctors. They all use the expression, oh, it's brutal to do that. Because but a patient has a right to do that as long as it could not be interpreted as some sort of a suicidal. Where a person doesn't want to suffer the pain of an extended type of thing, he has a right to give an advance directive, I don't want that to happen. And that's what Ramesh is saying about if it's a process already of termination or something of that sort, person has a right to do that. But of course he should do that if he's a halakhic thinking, a Torah thinking person, he should try to think it through and discuss it with the Bali Havor to give him a balance in that. It should not be just an arbitrary thing. You know, there are a lot of people, I once was at a seminar where they had someone from the Reform camp was discussing their attitude, and it was not a debate, it was a seminar, and there were a couple of physicians, so there were a lot of elderly people present. They looked everything, they had no understanding of the sanctity of human life, of what a life means, and all of that, like I started out with, about to whom it belongs. They said, makes a lot of sense, put me out of my misery. You know, they're talking those terms. You can't really say that. The person has to consult and get some sort of a, what we call halakhic guideline. But a person does have a right to make his decisions. He should make different decisions about these particular things. He doesn't want to have what they call the heroic measures taken to keep him alive with machines and all that kind of stuff when it really has no palliative way of doing things. So he can make these advanced directives. It would be legal even halacha, but he should first consult, you know, and though sometimes there might be good chances of surviving something by getting a certain medicine, so then he should not be arbitrarily making that statement. There are some certain type of situations. And then again, Ramesha, just to add, says that some people suffer terrible accidents, young people, or take a lot of drugs. So there we don't just say, well, the person's brain dead. No, they have to investigate. Maybe there's a way of getting rid of that and the patient may recover from that. And, you know, things of that sort. They're talking about in situations where it's been a long or terminal disease and things are affected in such a way that he's lost irreversible brain damage. Yes?
You spoke before about the morphine drip issue.
You're right.
And I understand that there's a tension, there's a balance between wanting to alleviate somebody's pain.
Yeah.
But knowing full well that the morphine will suppress respiration and possibly stop that.
Yeah, but it depends.
Would you talk some more about that?
Well, I'm just saying that she used the words, this person, experienced nurse, used to administering on the doctor's orders on the chart, morphine for pain management. But when he says an accelerated, she understood what he's at. He's another Miss Dr. Death in disguise, you know. He's finishing that patient off. She didn't want it, so I asked her, will you have any repercussions if you don't do that? He says, no, it's a conscience matter. if I say on a basis of my conscience, religion, I can't do that, someone else will do it, but I'm not going to do it. So I says, don't do it.
But not necessarily.
But this is the delicate balance.
That's
all
what
the
I'm
time.
Asking about.
This is delicate. There's a lot of things about risk factors where you can have, or where if a patient is allowed to live or expire the way he is, it'll take a couple of months or a couple of weeks. But there's a chance of an operation or a medical or surgical procedure that can make them, if they go through it, it will definitely last more than a year or two. So, but if it fails, he'll die maybe in 2 days on the table. So can you risk that or not? So that's a discussion in the Gemara, and the Gemara says that Ein Cheshishin, we're not concerned, that we're looking at the long run, if there's possible to save him in the long run. So we're not Cheshish L'chaye Shor, for the momentary absolute gift of life. If you can have the gift of life long, you're allowed to take that risk. That's a discussion in the Gemara. The Gemara in the Veda Zohar has that, and they bring it in all the Sefarim.
One more question.
You alluded to the situation where someone's already in the process of dying.
Yeah.
Some diseases can take are terminal, but can take months or even years.
Right.
Is that different if the terminal process is one that's...
Well, it depends whether it can be delayed or kept on or so forth. You have to talk with the physicians. I can never make that particular decision. I have to ask them, what's your prognosis? You have to get, yes, one or two in prognosis on things of that sort. And sometimes they will be very indefinite, so I'm not going to make a psak on an indefinite thing. I will opt for life, not for shortening or so forth. So, but other times when they say it's just a matter, I mean, I recently in a certain case where the physician said on someone it's only a matter of 2-3 weeks, and they were right. The mistake was it lasted another week, four instead of 2-3. So that's they were quite right. You know, it wasn't something that is will take so many years or whatever it is. That's all.
Your last question.
I have to. You have to speak louder.
I presume that the sanctity of life is connected to the sanctity of the neshama, not so much the goof.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, it's an integral. You know, it's body soul. It works together.
Okay.
You can't just ignore one without the other.
So, in the cases of the very elderly who have dementia.
Yes.
And. I've heard the expression, the care of the neshama is important, not just the goof.
Right.
But if the person can't recognize the yontif, or yeah. Shabbos, or certainly can't daven anymore, and how is the children or whoever's caring for the person helping the neshama besides perhaps providing kosher food?
We don't really, but the main thing is that person is a fully live person. Regardless, it's the same way, talk about Chereshayt of a cotton that the Gemara talks about. As someone who's deaf and dumb, someone who's an absolute mental case, if a person were to kill that person, that's murder. Whereas the ancient Greeks, in certain societies, and even what they call the Native Americans, anybody that was too old or disabled, they left them behind on the plains. The Greeks, if you read in Plato's Republic, talks about weeding out those weak people and, you know, the highly civilized culture and all, of getting rid of those who are disabled. They have no place for them. And Hitler, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, part of it, he had a whole policy of, there's a whole book that I have in my library, so about the psychiatrist was Hitler. They were murdering tens of thousands of people that were mentally disabled before they ever came to the extermination camp. It had nothing to do with Jews. They were getting rid of disabled people because they didn't consider them a mensch. And we can't do that. If a person is a human being, regardless of his mental capability or not, you cannot hurt him. You can't hurt and destroy him. You can't do that. That's a responsibility of being, of believing and following the ways of Torah. We only pray that people should be spared us from all of these particular things. And whatever medical advances are to help cure that, we should be in the forefront of that. Like with the stem cell research and so forth, which is itself a different halachic problem, which I believe very strongly that they could use the embryonic early development for that. It does not contravene halacha. I wrote a whole thing about that. Because in practice, it can save people. They experimented with the injections and the infusion of that. People in stages of beginning stages of dementia or Alzheimer's, there are remarkable discoveries that can be made. That's all.
Rabbi, I think just one aspect of the question, just to follow up, would be if a person is not cognizant or if they don't have their faculties, is there any purpose in saying Kiddush for them, saying Tillim with them? What is the care for
them? Well, you try to do the best that you can, that's all. I can't say anything more. That's all there is to it. You never know what's going on in there. We really don't know. We don't know. So we try the best that we can.
Even if someone's in a coma,
the person is like, that's like Munach Kemes. He's just helpless, dying.
People come out of it.
Well, if he does. In fact, well, you see, I have in my folder here, I have several long articles from neurologists that I know that have done great, the latest research. And when somebody came up and said, well, the fact that the heart is beating, we know cases where they came out of the coma and they recovered. So when they researched those cases, they found out that the neurologists didn't do their job. They did not investigate the disability of that person, so that's why he nearly never was really brain dead. It was just, they didn't do cut, you know, cross the T's and dot the I's and that. That's why it's emphasized, it has to be a thorough neurological examination with all means possible to make sure that before you make any decisions. That's all.
I want to thank the Rav, I want to thank the Skidelskis and everyone for coming. We'll now prepare to daven.